Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, episode 25, 3D, the good, the bad, and the ugly. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/theater. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. This week's guest geeks are Greg LeDuc and Dave Gregory, both stereographers with long years and long careers in Hollywood, who have worked on 3D projects, including the most recent 3D video shoot at the AIX Records recording session that I attended last week. Hey, Dave and Greg, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Hi.
Before we get started, I want to invite anyone who is tuned in to the live video stream at live.twit.tv or logged on to the chat room at irc.twit.tv to post questions for Greg and Dave, and I'll pass on as many as I can. but let's start with the real issue that I want to address with you guys, because you are both stereographers, which is a term that essentially means cinematographers in stereo or 3D. I want to talk about what really makes good 3D. We've now seen a lot of it in the theaters. We're starting to see it at home now. But I suspect that there are certain things that stereographers such as yourselves need to keep in mind in order to improve the experience or make the experience good. How would each of you sort of define what makes good 3D? Greg, let's start with you.
I think something sort of abstract, like just the time to do it right, is really, really important, because a lot of people try to rush things nowadays, and this is like anything. Quality takes time. So that's my first thought on the subject of 3D.
Mm-hmm. Dave, how about you?
My prime directive is audience comfort.
Yes.
And don't do things that cause the audience's eyeballs to feel like they're being yanked out.
So, for example, what sorts of things, first of all, would you not want to do? Would you want to avoid because they make the audience's eyes feel like they're getting yanked out?
Well, there's two things that can create problems in viewing 3D. What we call negative parallax. This is when something is coming out at the screen, maybe a little too far, too often, too frequently. The other thing is positive parallax, where your objects in the background at infinity are the two points, the two what they call homologous points that represent the left eye and the right eye, might be split too far apart. And it's easier to accommodate that if you're watching a 3D movie, if you sit far away from the screen in the back and the center. If you get too close to the screen and say those background points are too wide, you become what Marty Feldman had to do with his eyes to fuse on those objects. So that can be very uncomfortable. And so you want to keep things within a reasonable range. Avatar was very conservative in its approach towards 3D, and it was a very comfortable view for most people. Some people, if you caught it on the web, some people said some things about having headaches with it, but I think those people may have been sitting too close to the screen or too far at the sides, very close to the theater, and probably experienced difficulty watching it from those positions.
Greg, I imagine you'd more or less agree with that, eh?
I would, and I would say that comes down to the sweet spot, finding the sweet spot and holding on to it, whether it's in a theater or if you go out and get the new 3D TVs, LED or LCD. The sweet spot's what it's all about.
Now, you're talking about the sweet spot of where you're sitting with respect to the screen? The distance you're sitting from the screen?
The distance. And, in other words, if you're in the center, it's going to be a better shot or a better view than if you're off to the side. Or, as David said, up too far up front, too far in back.
Mm-hmm. I've always thought that the size of the screen made a big difference, or this, I should say the amount of your visual field that the screen occupies makes a big difference in 3D. And 3D, as far as I know, requires really that the screen occupy much more of your visual field than a 2D image. Would you guys agree with that?
I would.
It's a difficult call, because the one thing you can't control when you're making a 3D movie is the size of the screen that it's going to be projected on. And where I was talking about those points in the background being too large, you can set it for a 60-inch home video screen. You may design it for a 35-foot theater screen, and these are going on bigger and bigger screens all the time. So, you know, it's going to be different when you project onto a 60-foot screen. So those are all things that kind of you have to kind of average them out. And what a lot of stereographers are doing is we're shooting movies roughly thinking about a 45 to 50-foot screen in a theater.
Mm-hmm. But then how does that translate down to a, you know, a 46-inch or a 52-inch LCD TV? Does this mean that viewers of 3D in their home need to sit a whole heck of a lot closer to the screen than they otherwise might?
Not necessarily. I mean, we're talking about home theaters here, which have somewhat larger screens for the home, almost proportionately sized as you would have in a theater. I personally believe, for myself, I get as far back as I comfortably can. But there's a difference between how you approach 3D for a regular theater screen and, say, for an IMAX screen, where you don't really see the edges of the screen at all. You're not aware of them. So things can actually afford to come out a little bit more because you're not trying to fit things in to fall behind a stereo window, if you will.
Mm-hmm. That's one thing I've heard, is that stereographers need to be aware of where that window is and not try to put things outside of it, or try to, as you said earlier, put things too far forward or too far back. One thing I really object to in 3D movies, some of them anyway, is the gimmicky angle. For example, Monsters versus Aliens. Did you guys see that one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In one shot, very early on, one of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence guys is sitting there banging one of these paddles with a ball on a rubber band. And he's banging it right into the audience. And that just... it just is very distracting to me. It's very gimmicky looking, and I'm glad both of you are advocating don't do that.
Well, I think that to a certain degree, though, audiences want to see off-screen effects. Otherwise, they don't feel they're getting, you know, their money's worth out of the 3D. And in that particular scene, that's actually an in-joke. It's an, you know, Monsters versus Aliens was making a lot of nods to the 50s science fiction films, and...
Yeah.
That was a reference to a sequence in House of Wax, which there's, you know, back in those days they were running film, and so there had to be an intermission break in the middle of the movie because both projectors were showing the film. So when the film came back from the intermission, Jack Warner insisted that there be a couple of minutes of miscellaneous activity going on before the plot picked back up again. So there was a sequence of a man with a paddle ball in front of the House of Wax, who was like a barker, you know, trying to get people in. And so there were a lot of gags done with a paddle ball. And I think that was a reference in Monsters versus Aliens to House of Wax, actually.
Wow. That's hilarious. Greg, you and Dave both worked on this AIX records shoot in which Mark Waldrop, who has been a guest on the podcast before, was recording what he calls private performances on a stage in a very nice auditorium, capturing wonderful live performances. And he was having video shot of the performances this time for the first time in 3D, and that's where you guys came in. What sorts of techniques or ideas, philosophies did you bring to bear on that particular project?
Well, we wanted to give depth to the performances, but we didn't want to distract. So we were looking at more. I think, and you can double check with David on this, but we were being a little more conservative on the setups so that we didn't take away from the musicians and what they were doing. Mm-hmm. But certain shots lent themselves, like the grand piano was a great shot. And we did have the jib arm, so we got this flying view. But we had a certain amount of rehearsal, so we knew what we were getting. But it was mm-hmm. more about the music and adding depth to music than making it something that people were going to just be looking at with and being distracted from the key element, which is the music.
Right, right. I got a reader letter about I wrote about the shoot, as you guys both know, and I got a reader letter saying that, well, wait a second, the camera angle and the where the music is coming from are disconnected because you've got the microphones on stage and so on. The music should seem like it's coming from where the camera is, but I don't think any videos music videos are shot that way, are they?
No.
Not to my knowledge, no.
Yeah, you're when always you're mixing... trying... Sorry, ahead.
Well, I said when you're mixing production sound in a movie, you do try to emulate the perspective of the camera. But mm-hmm. in a situation like this where it's being mixed for the music, I'm sure Mark mixes his audio so that you get the effect of being in a live concert. And if we were to actually change that perspective relative to the perspective of each individual shot, it would drive you crazy to listen to, I'm sure, because the instruments would be cutting from the right side to the left side of the screen, and it would be more distracting. And that's not what that's about. You know, you want to give a nice relative, even performance, or at least a sonic reproduction of everything that's there without jumping around.
Yeah, exactly. So why don't each of you, I'd love to hear what each of you has done other than the AIX shoots for 3D. What other projects have you worked on with 3D? Dave, let's start with you.
Yeah. Well, I've been a still stereographer since 1983. And so I've done a lot of stuff, you know, and if you go into IMDb, you'll see basically most of my background has been in optical visual effects. Mm. And so... that's basically, I've just been making that transition. Even though I've been in motion pictures for years, I'm now using my stereoscopic knowledge for current projects. And AIX is one of the first ones I've done, actually, in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Greg, how about you?
Actually, up until this moment, mostly it was about theory. And I was, testing, but the actual production... This was a pleasant first experience for actual production, especially in video.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, I guess just about everybody, most people in the industry are, in fact, having to learn new skills now that we're really plunging headlong into 3D. So you guys aren't alone. Where can people learn more about this, pros such as yourself? Have you taken classes or is anybody offering anything in the way of training to get people hip to the techniques that really need to be used to do good 3D?
Well, I can say that Creatosphere was offering 3D and will continue to offer 3D, and they had a really nice one-day course. Now, Sony at the Culver City Center, they're offering a four-day course, and I'm looking forward to taking that. And Panasonic is working right now on planning their course. Mm-hmm. And then I understand that a number of other companies are all developing these courses just because there is a big need, as well as Local 600 is working on their courses, which is tied in with all of the other camera manufacturers.
Now, Local 300 is a chapter of...
Excuse me, Local 600.
If 600.
I, it's oh, Local 600, 600. Sorry. Local chapter of a cameraman's union?
That's the Cinematographers Guild, yes.
Cinematographers Guild. Okay, great. Let's see. I did see a little bit about the Sony thing, and I'm actually going down to Sony later this week to get a more extensive tour of their 3D training facilities. So I'm looking forward to that very much. So what 3D movies have you seen, and which ones do you think... really did the right things as opposed to the wrong things. Dave, you mentioned Avatar earlier, and I agree with you that they were relatively conservative, which is why the 3D worked so well. One reason, anyway. What other movies? Obviously, we can point to Clash of the Titans as an example of something that didn't do very well. And partly okay. that's because it was, and partly that's because I believe it was a 2D to 3D conversion.
Yes, yes.
So well, talk okay. a little bit about 2D to 3D conversion, along with any other examples you can think of good or bad 3D.
Boy. Okay. In terms of 3D movies, do you want me to speak in terms of recent 3D movies, movies
yes,
that have come
course.
Out in the last few years? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the majority of them have been CG tunes. And
right.
I was actually, I mean, Chicken Little was the first one to appear, and it was actually very conservatively handled. It was handled very well. My favorite was the one that came out right after that was Monster House, which I was just sort of made for, you know, monster kids like me. Of the live action films, I actually did not, I saw segments of My Bloody Valentine, but I didn't actually see the whole film. I just wasn't particularly interested in watching a pickaxe go through a teenager's skull and having it, you know, dangle out over the third row.
Thank you very much.
But on the other hand, Final Destination, the 3D version of that that came out, was it a year ago maybe? That one was handled very well. It was an entertaining movie. Of course, it has, you know, all of the plot trappings that all of the Final Destination series films have, but it was very well made, and I enjoyed that. I thought it was handled quite well all the way through it. I'm trying to think of, okay, two conversions. Well, what can I say about Clash of the Titans? I missed the DGA screening I was supposed to go to, and my friend Ernie Farino, who's also a visual effects supervisor and director in his own right, went that day, and he told me it didn't bother him, that it seemed okay, but there didn't seem to be any point in it. I took that as a good sign, actually, until I saw it myself over at the AMC in Burbank, and I was greatly disturbed. That, you know, if you want to argue from the standpoint of some executive at Warner Brothers who greenlighted that, it may have been a good decision in that respect, even though it was a rush job. They had 9 weeks to do it in, and it shows. I'd say maybe 10% of the shots in that film were perfectly acceptable, but it was the other 90 that went from, you're kidding me, to how dare they even think they can get away with that. Mm. And I mean, just to give you examples of what was going on inside that film is, you know, you shoot a close-up of someone's head, there's that contour of their face against a background. Well, very often that contour, okay, that's, we're pushing that forward into the foreground, and an area around the head would all, from the background would be pushed forward along with it. Conversely, some of the shots would have the head, this part of the head pushed back into the background, and only this portion of the face coming out. And I just found it incredibly disturbing because, you know, the way our brains interpret what we see, and stereopsis really occurs in the brain. I mean, that's where all of this comes together. We have two mm-hmm. viewpoints that gets mixed. It's almost telling your brain that everything you know is wrong. And I was actually disturbed emotionally for days after that. Now, the good news is the sequel for Clash of the Titans has been announced, and they're going to film it in 3D to begin with.
Mm.
But conversions can be good. I've seen very good conversions. The company N3 in Woodland Hills, I saw a couple years ago, they had converted the first 10 minutes of the original Star Wars movie, and it was so good it looked like it had been shot in 3D. It was
wow.
it was done
wow.
beautiful. And there are converted scenes in Avatar. Sometimes when you, let me just stop and just say that I feel you should shoot a movie correctly in 3D in the first place, but you're always going to have problem shots. Or something's going to go wrong maybe with one of the two cameras or one of the two eyes. Conversions can be fallen back to in that position, you know, when you need to go in and fix something. I've seen beautiful conversions done. Mm. But don't try to do an entire feature film in 9 weeks. On the other hand, on the other hand, Clash of the Titans stayed in the top 10 box office for quite a few weeks. So, you know,
surprising.
Who am I to say they made the wrong decision? But I would much rather have seen the film in 2D, and I think I would have enjoyed it a lot more if I'd seen it in 2D.
Greg, do you agree?
Yes.
Greg, what did you think of Alice in Wonderland, which was another conversion that I thought was not bad?
I have been working so much, I haven't seen Alice in Wonderland yet.
no chance to go out to the movies.
But I will say that James Cameron's a big influence, because what's really stuck in my mind is when he did Titanic, the documentary in 3D, and I saw it in IMAX, it was just incredible. I was just so absorbed, and I thought, this is it. Mm. And he says when he's making his movies, he doesn't make them for the iPhone. He's making them for the big screen.
Yeah. Good. Well, listen, we got some questions from the listeners and people who are online with us. We have a question from Stop Hayton, who asks, how is this generation of 3D different from the old red and blue glasses version from years ago? Who wants to take a stab at that?
I'll take a stab at that. What red and blue system from years ago? This is a common misconception that people have about 3D of yore. All of the films in the 50s were shot with two cameras and generally projected in theaters with two projectors with polarizing filters. What happened was back in, I guess by the late 50s and the early 60s, there were some films that used the anaglyph process of red and cyan or red and green or red and blue because it was cheaper. Because you didn't have to have two projectors running at the same time. You didn't have to have a special silver screen. And the glasses were cheaper to make. But really, if you've seen the movies that were shot in the 50s, almost all of them were really very, very well shot. And if you saw them projected properly, they looked gorgeous. The only problem was is that there was a challenge. Projectionists were being challenged to get it right. And the theaters didn't want to really have to spend the extra money. The union required them to have a second projectionist, which, to be honest, they needed, because it's a lot of work. You know, you're rewinding films, getting the next reel up. It's a very labor-intensive job. And just like, remember, three-panel Cinerama had to have, what, 2, 3, 4, 5 projectionists just to run everything? Mm-hmm. You had to have two projectionists to run that, so it was an extra expense for the theater, unlike today where it's digital projection. And all of the errors that could have crept into the past have pretty much, well, they pretty much designed the systems to be projectionist goof-proof, if you will. that doesn't mean that accidents can't happen. There have been some issues with servers going down and things like that. But for the most part, I haven't gone to any film, say, projected in the Real D process that's ever had an issue in projection. I only had one issue, and that was when the projectionist turned the light on in the booth and I could see the light hitting the screen.
Oh, man!
I won't name the theater it was at, but it happened twice on two different 3D movies shown at the same cinema.
I'm hoping that projectionist does not have a job anymore. Well, that seems pretty inexcusable.
But let me just say that red cyan can actually be used very effectively if you know what you're doing. Certainly you can project black and white movies that way and code them, but you can do color films if you actually are very careful about what colors you're passing through and you mute those colors so that you don't get what's called retinal rivalry. And that's where, like, you know, if you look at something that's red on screen through the cyan filter, it's going to go black, and through red it's going to be real light, and you're going to get a sort of a shimmying. You have to adjust that so that the red gets subdued and doesn't create that shimmying effect. Which means you can use red cyan effectively, but you have to compromise the art direction and mute the color to make it to work.
Mm-hmm. Red cyan, or anaglyph as it's called, has been used for 3D television up till now, because it was possible to send that over standard bandwidth, over standard communication channels. But it is pretty compromised in my view. Greg, why don't you tell us a little bit about how now that we've heard from Dave about the 3D in the past, two projectors, film running through them, two projectionists. Now, of course, we have digital, which makes things a whole lot easier. What can you tell us about that?
Right. Well, actually, I was in meetings the last few days, and the meetings are all about, because I have a background in TV commercials, doing things for the internet, because a lot of clients don't want to go to broadcast or into the theaters. So our big thing now is how to best project for the internet so they can put the products there. And the other thing is, this technology changes so fast, is just when you start getting comfortable with one thing, there's something else that comes out. And it's always better. So at this point, my big push is to learn how to get the best 3D viewing for the internet.
Hmm. And certainly that's going to require some serious data compression, because you want to be able to send that information in as little bandwidth as possible. And yet I would think 3D imagery requires by its nature more bandwidth than an equivalent 2D stream. Would you agree?
Yes. Yes. So I'm thinking is that what will probably happen is the corporate sponsors that we have for doing these things will set it up in an area where they can handle that end of it. So it would probably be more for a public display, like a convention or whatever, so that it can be shown there and mm-hmm. go over as opposed to broadcast or in the theater. But that's what right. we're looking into right now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to get back to reader and listener questions in just a moment. But before we continue, I want to thank our sponsor for this episode, Audible.com, a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For listeners of Home Theater Geeks, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook you might consider downloading is The Pixar Touch by David Price. I'm particularly interested in learning about the company that made so many great animated movies, and I expect so many more in the future, including the new Toy Story 3 in 3D, which I'm going to see tomorrow evening at IMAX here in Burbank. So I'm really looking forward to that. Everything I've heard says it's fantastic, both in terms of 3D and in terms of story, which Pixar is really, really great at. To download this audiobook or another one of your choice for free, go to audiblepodcast.com/theater. That's audiblepodcast.com/theater. Okay, we got a bunch more questions here for Dave and Greg. So one of them from AJ Rube asks, how long until we see 3D without needing glasses on a large scale? Is there any hope of that anytime soon?
I've heard manufacturers say 3 to 5 years. That's what they're saying. We'll see. It could be quicker. And will it really work when it comes? We don't know.
Good question. Yeah, it's a good bit of speculation there. We don't really know. I've heard some people say 10 years before we see large screen. Now, we do have small screen even now. This new Nintendo little portable game thing, I think, has some 3D nature to it. Somebody else here has asked a question about that. I also saw at the recent CEA line shows last week a small, I think it was a PSP, PlayStation Portable, that had a pretty nice looking 3D screen on it. One of the things that I've heard is that it's relatively easy to do it on a small screen, relatively hard to do on a big screen. Dave, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. I was at E3 a couple of weeks ago and I saw the Nintendo, and it's cute, but to get autostereoscopic displays, and unless someone comes up with some other technology, what you're basically having to do is put a vertical raster over the screen in some way, which, of course, isolates each of the two perspectives for each eye. Mm-hmm. That compromises the horizontal resolution of the image. Yep. And with small devices, it works okay. Even there's computer screens, laptops that do this. But if you're talking about a theater, I don't see how we're going to get away from glasses for a long time. The Russians did this years ago in the Stereo 70 format. They had theaters that were polarized, and then they had theaters that had a special interference screen. Well, as you know, in any autostereo display, you have to sort of stand or look at it as a sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, imagine doing that to an auditorium. Okay, you can sit here, you can sit here. No, you can't sit there. You have to move over. What's practical? I don't believe you're going to see that happen for a long time.
Yeah.
And if you want to see 3D in a theater, go to live theater. You don't have to wear glasses for that.
Right. The actors on the stage are actually in 3D.
They're actually there. No retinal rivalry issues either. You know,
yes, exactly. Now, this is an issue another issue that I have thought about a lot in terms of needing a big screen, which we were talking about earlier, which is if the 3D image, or the stereoscopic image, I should say, does not really fill your field of view, you can see things in the environment outside of that screen, and they look different. No matter how well a stereoscopic image is done, it's not the same as looking out in the real world. And so I tend to believe that there's a conflict going on in your brain between the stereoscopic image on the screen and the actual real world 3D objects that are sitting outside of the screen, if the screen isn't really filling your field of view. How do you guys feel about that?
Well, what you're describing, a real perspective, a real 3D perspective from something projected is called, the term is called orthostereo, and that's where you've actually matched your field of view and your and the depth to the object you're seeing. That's only going to happen in rare instances in certain situations. 3D cinema is an illusion of depth. And what I think you're trying to describe, Scott, is when you're looking at a 3D movie, technically, even though the image is focused on the screen isn't there. You're looking through a window subjectively. And if you have an object coming forward, it has to be completely contained within the screen. If it gets occluded by the edges, if it gets cut off, then suddenly you have half of an object in forward theater space, you know, if it's coming forward. So generally we try to keep things so that they're framed behind that screen, so that then if it goes to the edge of the screen, it feels like you feel like it's going behind. Mm-hmm. If you see it going forward, it's a bit of a violation and it somewhat spoils the effect. However, that isn't to say that you can't do that. We actually did that on this AIX shoot occasionally, where I'd push things just a little bit forward, and this was basically to accommodate the objects in the background, prevent them from making split too much. And the audience actually, I think, appreciates that because they can see a little bit more depth, but you just have to be careful. You don't have something going too far out and then disappearing on the sides. Now in IMAX, it's a different situation because you're not seeing the edge of the screen. So you can afford to have things coming forward more. In fact, you kind of have to because the image is so big.
Right.
The problem with that is are you generating eye strain on the part of the viewer by having things coming forward all the time? Because you're doing two things. You're essentially asking the viewer to decouple two aspects of his vision. One is convergence, you know, when something is coming forward, our eyes toe in on it. And then the other is focus. We're also refocusing on something getting closer to our eyes. But when we see a 3D movie, when something's coming forward, our eyes are converging on it, but the lenses of our eyes have to remain focused the distance we are seated to the screen. So that can create headaches if you're doing a lot of off-screen effects. And the first IMAX 3D film I saw, which was, T-Rex Back to the Cretaceous? Ooh, everything was, an hour-long movie, and everything was coming off of the screen, and we all had whopping headaches at the end of that.
This relates, Greg, I think, to the some of the production notes you sent me. One of them is, do not use actors or props to frame the picture.
Right, yes. And I just want to go back to the axe when we were shooting that. The great thing is we had four cameras, and it wasn't something where we had to get it with one shot. So in setting it up, we knew, if it didn't work in one, we had three other options, and we could cut to that. And so it was going to be an editing process that allowed that experimentation. So that's one nice thing about that. But, I put those rules together before the production. And rules are made to be broken, so a lot of
wow. Here's an interesting question from Elky SS iPad. He flies RC airplanes and would love to mount a small 3D video camera on the nose. Are there any 3D video cameras that small that one could buy? I mean, they are getting smaller. You guys were using Panasonic 3D cameras on the AIX shoot that were, you know, surprisingly small, but you couldn't mount them on the nose of an RC plane.
You know, that's something, like a great seriously, idea. You can, you can go to Savon or CVS and buy these little prefab video cameras that shoot like, I think, Greg, correct me if I'm wrong, I think they're like 720 by 1280, but But, you know, they're disposable and they're about this thick, you know, and they can't weigh that much. I mean, if you want to stick a couple of them side by side and tape them together and turn them on, you're not necessarily going to have your images gen locked, but you might be able to get something. And depending on how big your helicopter is and how powerful it is, you may be able to pull it off. I have a good friend who just recently got involved with model helicopters, and he's excited about putting a camera on the front end and doing mm-hmm. things like that. But and of course, I on a film that I'm planning, I definitely want to do a shot like that in the open for the opening. And yeah, I've been thinking, oh, how am I going to get that in 3D?
How am I going to do that? Greg, yeah. Is there any way to lock those two separate cameras together like that?
Actually, I think Samsung has a new $800 3D camera, and it also does a little bit of video. Now, the article I read said that seeing the video is something else, but it does have that capability. So as far as inexpensive, that's one way to go. And then to answer your question, the part of locking it is the part that makes it too heavy to do unless you go to a bigger airplane.
Yeah, right.
And more
right,
expensive.
Really,
so.
Really bigger well, airplane.
Actually, I would like to recommend my friend Eric Kurland has a website. I think it's called doityourselfdiy3d.com. I'll have to double check that. But he has got two of these little cameras together, and he has he's figured out a hack to get into the camera and basically lock them. And he's got the whole thing in a little Altoids box, basically, with the two cameras.
Wow. Maybe that might be the answer to the question.
Well, maybe you can get Eric on this, on the show here, and we can have him talk about it at another time.
Sure, sure. I actually believe that 3D improves the experience. Let's get philosophical. Greg, what do you think? Does 3D actually improve?
For sports, totally. And for music, my favorite 3D movie is U2 3D. Love the film. So for those two, I think it does. Other things, it's questionable.
Dave, what do you think?
Oh, that's a loaded question, isn't it?
I get a lot of reader letters who say, this doesn't improve the experience. It only detracts from it.
It can. If the 3D isn't done well, then I'd rather just see a 2D movie. I mean, I would much rather watch Clash of the Titans in 2D. In fact, I actually like this remake. As big as I'm a Ray Harryhausen fan, I actually like the remake better than the original film as a movie. But to have watched it in 3D, oh, God. it wasn't. I mean, I told you earlier, I was disturbed for several days afterwards. It's just working on parts of my brain that I just didn't want touched. Okay, two answers to the question. Let me paraphrase the question a little bit. Should every movie made be in 3D? Mm-hmm. My personal answer is no. Are you kidding? I wouldn't want it. I think that would take away from the novelty of 3D to a degree. Mm. On the other hand, could every movie made be in 3D? And I would say, yeah, there's no reason why not. I mean, give me just about any situation, I could figure out a way to handle it in 3D. Now, is that going to enhance the value of the movie? I don't know. Did the 3D and the phony 3D of Clash of the Titans enhance the value of the movie? It irritated the hell out of me, but it sure did well at the box office. I just think that people are going to get wise to this. I think the consumer is going to get wise to it after a while, and especially if the theaters and the distributors. This whole premium experience fee of adding an extra $4 or more to the ticket is going to wear thin with the public, especially during a recession. And it has already shown signs of affecting the box office a little bit. I don't mind an extra, you know, a $2 charge, one for the glasses, one to help the theater pay for the additional equipment of showing 3D. But when you start adding $4 or more, I mean 25 to 50% more per ticket. If you have a family of, you know, four kids and you take the wife, I mean, what, you're going to be spending $100 to get in the door and you haven't even hit the concession stand yet. So I think people might be opting to go see the movie in 2D if that keeps up. And I hope they don't kill the goose that laid the golden egg here and by basically affecting a greed factor into the ticket price.
I certainly hope so, too. I've written about Roger Ebert's opinion of 3D, which he doesn't think much of it. And he asks the question, well, would you want Precious or Fargo or even Casablanca in 3D? You know, he can't imagine a serious drama in 3D. Greg, do you think there's any place for 3D in something other than sports or music or animation?
Well, in science fiction. In science fiction.
Yes, of course.
But drama is a question. I think it'll have to be done, and that's a rule that you have to break. You do it well, people say it can be done.
It's already been done. Dial In for Murder. Hitchcock's Dial In for Murder. I've seen it in 2D, and I've seen it in 3D. He shot it in 3D. And believe me, it's a much better movie in 3D.
Really?
Very conservative 3D. Oh, it's beautifully done. Beautifully done.
Wow. And, I think Roger Ebert claimed that Hitchcock did not like the result. I'm not sure if that's true or not.
Well, Hitchcock, I think, kind of resented the fact that Jack Warner was shoving the process down his throat. And he used a reduced interocular, you know, this distance. He pulled it in down a bit to make
By the way, the interocular distance is the distance between the eyes. Between the lenses in the case of the
between
camera.
Between the lenses. Some people call it interocular. Some people call it interaxial. Some people call it interpupillary distance. I call it interocular. But he pulled that in. He was trying to minimize the effects somewhat. The effect of that was that went for one of the most comfortable 3D movies ever to watch. And most of the subjects are converged at, so they're at the plane of the window. And it's a really lovely film to watch. It's totally comfortable when it's projected, right? I saw it projected out of focus recently, which was a big disappointment. But when it's projected right, it's fun, and it adds more to it. It's sort of like I made that reference to live theater earlier. But it adds a lot. To me, it adds more enhancement to watching it, more involvement from a subjective standpoint as a viewer. And I got to tell you, I mean, he's very conservative, but have you seen the film before at all, even in 2D?
No, I can't say that I have.
Oh, okay. Well, there's the famous shot where Grace Kelly's hand goes back for that scissors. It's out there. It's in your face. And that's the only time anything comes out of the screen. And it works. And why does it work? It's motivated by the content. It's motivated by the content of the script. And that's why I think all off-screen effects in movies, oh, I use that term off-screen. Shame on me. there's an aside for that I'll go into if you want me to. But into theater space, which is easier to say. Into theater space or just off-screen?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean, I use off-screen. Anyone who's been in 3D for a long time will use that term. That doesn't mean we're as charlatan as two people with the last name that begins with C have said. that's ridiculous.
Who shall otherwise remain nameless.
Where do they think the image actually is? If you take off your glasses, where's the image? Where's it focused? It's on a screen. It's on a screen.
Yeah,
my
what
God.
Do you know?
So, yeah, anything for an off-screen effect, getting back to Dial M, that's the only off-screen effect that's actually in the movie.
That happens, yeah.
And it works perfectly. And I always say that off-screen effects in 3D movies have to be motivated by the content. It's just very simple. I mean, camera movement, actor movement, that should be motivated by the content, not just shaking around for the sake of being hip.
Yeah. Here's a question that Roger Ebert also complains about. The question asks, how do these guests feel about infinite focus versus narrow depth of field? And I know that Roger Ebert talked about, these 3D movies, they have infinite depth of field, and that's very unnatural because when we're looking out into the real world, we focus on different things, and things at different distances are out of focus compared with what we're looking at. Now, I know that you guys, when you were shooting AIX, the AIX videos, I noticed that the cameras, these Panasonic cameras, have, in fact, irises, which would let you control the depth of field. So isn't that something that would normally be done by a cameraman?
Yes. Yes, it would be. But given the light level, we were all the way open. So our control was just open up and stay there. That's pretty much how we shot the whole show.
Yeah,
because the light level in that room was not very high.
Yes. To put it simply, yes.
We were limited. So what that means is that the depth of field of those shots was relatively narrow, and things that you were not focused on behind or in front of would, in fact, be somewhat out of focus, correct?
Right, yes. And it worked in that situation.
Well, first of all, we're shooting with cameras that have relatively small chips. So it's just like, you know, shooting 16 millimeter versus 35 in one sense, in that, you know, you have greater depth of field with a smaller chip camera. But what Ebert is talking about, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Look, when we're focusing at different things, when we look at things, we're not seeing shallow depth of field. That's an artifice that cinematographers create because we've been working in a 2D medium for years. And so that's how we attenuate depth on a 2D screen. In 3D, the reason Ebert says we're not seeing in focus on backgrounds or objects in the background are soft isn't because they are not necessarily in focus. They probably are in our field of vision. It's because we're not converged on them, and we're seeing double images. And when you look at a 3D movie, the idea is to keep a good depth of field because you're converging on different things. You know, and so there's two double images. And if you go subconsciously, the viewer will go to explore that depth, whether they mean to or not. They're going to see, to do that. And you have to have it sharp for them to be able to explore that depth. You can't have, in fact, it's very interesting. They learned on, I think it was Meet the Robinsons. I'm blanking on the person's name at the moment. I'll remember in a moment. But he stated that one of the 3D supervisors stated that they had something coming off screen and it was soft. It was in soft focus and it would drive the viewers crazy because they would try to converge on it, but it wouldn't go sharp because the image itself isn't sharp. So they actually had to redo that shot and have that object in focus. So when the viewers would go to fuse on it, and it was coming off screen, they would actually see a sharp image because that was what they expect to happen in reality when they're looking at something. Mm-hmm. But, actually, I think one of the greatest 3D movies ever made was not in 3D, but I could certainly imagine Citizen Kane in 3D. Now, stop and think about all those deep focus shots, you know, Agnes Moorehead in the foreground, the kid in the background, all through that. That movie has 3D written all over it. Wow. But does it need to be in 3D? Well, no, and I wouldn't necessarily want to see it converted because it's a classic, and I feel somebody would be tampering with a classic. On the other hand, I don't think it would hurt. If someone did a real good job, if, say, the company that did the first 10 minutes of Star Wars in 3, if they did a conversion on it, were given enough time and money, I think it would be something really splendid to look at. So, but, you know, again, you have to have time, you have to have enough time and money to do these things right. And my feeling is shoot them in 3D correctly in the first place. But when Ebert starts talking about depth of field and this, he's not a cinematographer, you know. You can't it, Roger.
Greg, I recently heard somebody refer to conversion, 2D to 3D conversion, as being analogous to colorization of black and white movies. And that made a lot of sense to me, don't you think?
It does. And there's another thing that our technique is getting better. And having a huge, huge stock footage library of 2D, I so look forward to this technique being perfected because all my 2D footage underwater, above the water, can be converted to 3D and I can start selling it again. So I'm really looking forward to this process being perfected.
Oh man, we're opening up a whole can of worms here because, you know, we had theatrical movies that were released on VHS videotape and then DVD and now Blu-ray and then Blu-ray 3D. It's like, oh my God, I have to buy the White Album all over again.
Right.
But it's going to depend on the quality of conversion that's being done. I mean, if it all ends up looking like Clash of the Titans did, forget it. And you know, I mean, the job of pixel pushing, most of these positions are now being farmed out to India, the Philippines, Korea, and some of these people are very good artists. But, you know, who's going to be supervising? Who's going to be calling the shots and saying, oh, that should That's okay. That's the way it should be. So, Greg, you have to supervise the conversion of those shots. And
indeed.
And you know, I mean, Jim Cameron is supervising the 3D conversion on Titanic, obviously, when he gets around to it. I don't know when that's coming out or how far along they are. And so this is something to, you know, to keep in mind is, yeah, it may be like colorization, but you just have to ask yourself, okay, does the subject matter of the film lend itself to this kind of treatment?
We always get back to that, don't we?
Yeah. I think it's in the content.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And there are always going to be people who are going to complain about colorization for one thing, who are going to complain about conversion for another. And to them I say, well, then get the black and white version. Get the 2D version. You know, no one's forcing you to watch it. Great. Well, I see by the old clock on the wall that we're almost out of time here. So I want to thank very much my guests, Greg LeDuc and Dave Gregory, for being my guests on the show this week. Very interesting conversation. Thanks, you guys.
Hey, thank you so much. It was fun.
Seemed like only 15 minutes. Did I go on that long?
Yeah. Well, you know, it does tend to do that. You can check Greg's website out at leducdesign.com. That's L-E-D-U-C design.com. My online homes are ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com. And you can email me at scott@twit.tv. You can also follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Twit is taking next Monday off in observance of the 4th of July holiday. Why they're taking the 5th off, I'm not 100% sure, but they're not the only ones. So tune in again in 2 weeks when my guest geek is scheduled to be George Walter, Vice President of Digital Projection, maker of the Titan 3D home theater projector that's due to arrive in our studio for review later this week or early next week. So I'll have a lot to talk about with him about that projector. Until then, geek out.